The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, June 12th, 2009. This is episode number 181, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today bringing you the best in motorcycle road racing coverage. And have we got a whopper of a show today. Before we get to telling you what's going on with the show, I want to send a big shout out thank you to Gary Chavit. Gary was kind enough to donate to the MotoGPOD cause. It's actually a second donation. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much, Gary. Help pay for the bandwidth and all that kind of stuff. We've got a really, really big show lined up for you today because we have not one, but two interviews with racers on the show today. We've got Don MD, Daytona 200 winner from, I believe it was 1972, on the show that Jules talked to down there at a Riders for Health organization down there in the Bay Area. Don MD was nice enough to give us some time, and it's a great interview. And Jim Race did a phone call with Sean Harris, who has raced in the Isle of Man TT several times and is over there this year helping out other guys that are doing their racing, considering a comeback. And not only did Sean Harris race in the Isle of Man TT, which is very, very cool in and of itself to have somebody like that on the show, but he raced a Briton. So this is a very unusual guy, one of the few guys that's actually ridden a Briton in anger. If you're not familiar with the Briton, you should look it up. It's a really, really cool, interesting motorcycle, and Sean talks in depth about it. Some interesting stuff, actually some stuff I'd never heard. And of course, we're also, Jules and I did a big call, Catalunya preview, and talked a little bit about the news and all that sort of stuff. So we've got that in there too. So why don't we start off with the Jules talking to Don MD down there at the Riders for Health meeting, and then we'll do the call with Jules, and then after that we'll finish up with the Sean Harris interview. So here we go.
Hey, this is Jules Cisek from MotoGPOD, and I'm here with Don MD, winner of the Daytona 200 in 1972. So we're here at a Riders for Health event in Livermore at the Tri-Valley Motors store, which is a fairly new place. I think it's been around here for about 6 months or so.
I think that's what they said, yes.
It's a dealership with BMW and KTM and Triumph, and it's filled with a lot of great bikes, especially a lot of orange bikes, which I love. So anyway, Don did a presentation on a little bit of his background, and we talked about Riders for Health with Adam Silver. And now I wanted to ask you some more specifics about the race that you're very famous for. You were on a fairly underpowered bike, I believe it was a Yamaha 350 two-stroke.
Yes.
And why don't you tell me and tell the audience, first of all, I have some questions about Daytona 200. Daytona 200 is a incredibly well-known venue, but it's a very strange track because, of course, of the banking, which is one of only race tracks that does both the banking and an infield. And it's kind of a crazy place to race motorcycles because you don't have any runoff when you're on the banking. If you crash into the banking there, it's pretty even these days, right?
And I think if they were probably created a track today and it had no history, it would probably be a difficult thing. People would probably say, why are you doing this? Because yes, it isn't like a traditional track because of the banking, the runoff. But I think the history is so great. I mean, because the race goes, of course, back to the 1930s when they used to race on the beach. In fact, my father was one of the winners on the beach one year on an Indian.
Oh, I should have mentioned that. That's right.
Yeah, and so it already had, from the 30s to 1960 of racing on the beach, it had that history. And then when Bill France created Daytona, and actually the first two or three years in Daytona, they didn't use the banking. They actually had an all-infield kind of course, so the first couple of years. And then eventually, I think 1963, they said, okay, the speeds are, we think we can race on the bikes. But these were bikes in the 1960s that would run a top speed of maybe 130 miles an hour or so, and it didn't seem so bad, going around the banking. But there's no question that it's a It's just something. But, you know, I look at it kind of like you could build the argument of why did they race at the Isle of Man?
Of course.
Totally absurd, right? But yet it's as popular as it ever was.
Yeah.
Because in England, you know, the people have grown up with it, and it's their history. It's a real iconic event for them. And I think Daytona, even though it's I think it's not the race that it once was, in terms of the prestige, but it's like our Isle of Man. Mm-hmm. And it certainly has that unusual situation with the banking, but luckily through the years, you know, there really have been there haven't been major incidents. There have been maybe just a few riders who have some problems on it, but it's we've gotten through, and they've continued to kind of work on the track, and they've gone back and forth to try to make sure they can keep the pace with the safety of the tires. And there were some years when tires were kind of a problem, but again, for the most part, again, I just look at it as it's unique to America, and I think the history that it has that unusual situation, but because of the banking, it's just there, so we deal with it.
So let's talk about the 1972 race.
Mm-hmm.
You actually went through a little bit of it before, and it was fascinating to hear. So I'd like to.
Thanks.
See if you could
The great thing about racing in the 1970s was the class format. You could have any bike from a 350cc bike up to a 750cc bike, so it opened up all kinds of brands. It wasn't like nowadays with Superbike where it's just these three or four bikes or five bikes could be. There were the Hondas, Yamaha, Suzuki's, Kawasaki's, Harley Davidson's, Norton's, on and on and on. It was just the brands that were out there were tremendous, and everybody had their particular machine. And It was a kind of a time of a little bit of change, because Suzuki and Kawasaki by then had their 750cc two strokes,
mm-hmm.
and they decided to go with those bikes, and they actually created bikes that were beyond what the tires would go for, and that they didn't. But see, there was no, in those years they didn't do a lot of testing. There wasn't like nowadays, like Dunlop will have the big tire test in January. That didn't happen in those days. They were testing the bikes maybe in Japan on flat long straightaways, but there wasn't the banking and the G-force, whatever. And so they knew they kind of they were going to probably have a problem, and they did. So basically, they built a motorcycle to race the Daytona 200 in 1972 that couldn't go 200 miles. Now, your listeners might be amazed to think in those years nobody thought of a tire change. We went the whole way on the same tires.
Really?
Yeah, there was no tire change. Nobody thought of a tire change until like almost 10 years later, around 1980 or so. But so we went the whole time in there. These were the days where axles and all the things. It wasn't quick change gear, and none of it existed. So the concept was you had to go 200 miles, and
just gas stops then,
and just gas stops exactly. Yeah. And but the thing about the 350 Yamaha was that we knew we could make it on one stop. The big 750s would have to make two stops.
Mm.
So right there, we felt we had an advantage of at least, 40 seconds, 50 seconds, maybe by the time somebody really got into the pits and gas and back going again. And it's funny because even though the big 750s were much faster, we knew they would have tire trouble. They did. None of them lasted more than 100 miles. And really, for me, the biggest issue was the other 50 or 60 guys on 350 Yamahas, just like exactly like mine. And that ranged from some no-name riders to guys like Kenny Roberts and Cal Carruthers and others. And so we had a good battle. And but I was actually injured the day before the race, and I had a great deal of confidence.
Before you get to that, I want to start with your confidence was that you were going to go into this place.
Yes.
You've raced the Daytona 200 before.
I had raced it the year before, and I grew up. I mean, my father had won it, and in San Diego there was we had numerous riders who had also won the Daytona 200, and I kind of grew up around a lot of these guys who Cal Rayburn and Brad Andries and Joe Leonard and my dad and Ed Kretz and these guys, and they were all friends of ours, and they had all had their stories of winning Daytona, so it was always in my mind, and that to me was maybe my greatest goal of racing was to win Daytona. So I really studied it, which ultimately led to me being able to do a book. I was always studying why did guys win, why did guys lose, what caused this guy to break, and I tried to think through all the reasons that could make me not win. And it is funny whether it's it kind of sounds like a karma kind of thing, but I probably had maybe four or five experiences in my racing career where I really got to myself to beyond the point of thinking I could win to the absolute point that I would win. And I really, and it happened with only one exception. At one time at Sacramento, in a dirt track race, a battery went dead right on the line. I had the same feeling, but I won a race at Oklahoma City, a dirt track, and I won a race in Talladega once, where I beat Cal Rayburn and Gary Nixon in the 250 race. And I had this feeling of I will win this race, and it came through every time. And so at Daytona, and it's the last time I actually had I ever had this feeling, but I actually had this feeling I would win this race. And I share this with you now. I didn't even tell that. I forgot to tell that start part earlier. But I just was so locked in. But then as I got to Daytona, I crashed in a 250 combined race, the GP race on the Saturday, and injured my shoulder. Was actually in the hospital, and I had to go Sunday morning to actually get my license back because they had to do a little medical test on me. Right. And get that back. And then okay, that was okay. And then my bike seized up early in the 200, and I was literally was. With my had the clutch in and was coming off of the east banking for the pits, and I just told myself, if you go in, you won't win. So instead of going to the pits, I kind of angled to the right and steered and actually let the clutch out and got the engine to unlock itself. And
what was the actual problem?
And the actual problem, most mechanics would say it was impossible, but when they finally took the cylinder off after the race, the circlip had come loose. And was actually kind of augering its way up, and the cylinder was okay, but it was eating into the piston, and it actually had eaten itself into the piston. But because I actually clutched it and let the clutch back out at probably over 100 miles an hour, it actually was able to free it up and spit the key out, the little circlip out. And when we took it off later, there was this whole big the ring was collapsed. But actually, the bike really ran fine, and it was amazing. And it was a little bit harder to get off of turn one. I had to slip the clutch a little more coming off of turn one. Was the 350? You had to be geared really high for the Yamaha 350. But other than that, it ran fine, and it ran the rest of the day. And so I got through my crash. I got through the bike seizing, and then had a great race with a former world champion Phil Reed. He and I raced until the pit stop, and then he had. All this sophisticated pit stop equipment, and they poured gas all over him, and he stalled the bike, and that put him back to fourth. And my father made me a quick fill can out of an old trash can, and I was in and out in like 9 seconds, and everything it went perfect. And so I was in a great race later in the event, and then my old friend Dick Mann, who I was on the BSA team the year before, was having engine trouble, but he came out. They got his bike running good. He came out just in time to get in between me when I was in second and a rider named Ray Hempstead on a same Yamaha like I had. And I'd been battling. Well, I'd been chasing him for a good 10 laps trying to pass him. And Dick got in his draft, and he towed me past and into the lead. And then his bike went bad from there. But anyway, so I was in this great battle and won the race. And it was a great thrill. And to this day, my father and I are the only father and son to both have won the Daytona 200. So that was my goal. And so I only really raced about one more year after that. I raced in 1973. I got seventh at Daytona on a Suzuki 750. Because I was convinced then, even having won on the Yamaha, that I was convinced that it was going to take a 750 to win. And wouldn't you know it, Jarno Saarinen came and won. Yamaha was 1-2-3. Yamaha was 1-2-3 the year I won with myself and Ray Hempstead and a guy named Dave Smith. And the very next year, Yamahas were 1-2-3 again with Jarno Saarinen and Kel Carruthers and a guy named Jim Evans, who then was on the bike that I had been on, not the same bike, but on the same sponsor for this next year. And I was seventh on a 750 Suzuki. Yeah. But then finally, it did come true that the big bikes were in, because in 1974, Yamaha came bumped up to a 700cc. Basically bolted two 350s together to make the 700cc, and then a year later they made that into a 750, and Giacomo Agostini came and he won Daytona, and so my win was the first of 13 in a row for Yamaha.
Oh wow!
From there, so
wow.
It was actually the
only time that a 350 won.
Well, no, and Jarno was on a 350 as well.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, but because of the fact that you could ride anything from three, that was the only time a 350 ever beat them, when myself and Jarno, our wins were the two smallest bikes that were ever won the 200. And then again, later the Yamaha even had the bigger bike, but it was, so we had so the kind of milestones for me were it was the first time that it was the first year Yamaha first time Yamaha ever won. It was the first time a two-stroke bike had ever won the 200
in 72.
and the smallest bike, and then me and my father Democrat. So it set some nice milestones and everything. I was very proud of. So
you were inducted into the Motorcycle Hall of Fame in
1999. Yeah, and from that, as was my father the year before, and this year I'm going to be going back to Ohio to the AMA, because at Mid Ohio I'm going to be the Grand Marshal of the Vintage Motorcycle Days this year.
Oh wow, so, excellent!
Yeah, and it's funny, and not because of Yamaha, but because the year before I was on the BSA factory team, and this year BSA is the kind of the mark of the year for them, whatever, and so they invited me to be the Grand Marshal and kind of celebrate my years with BSA.
That's cool. So did Circlip ever turn up?
The
circlip, did it ever turn up?
You don't actually know, and I didn't even know where the cylinder was. There was a guy who once, who was a friend of the Mel Dennison, who was a Yamaha dealer in Bakersfield. He's passed away now. And there was a guy who always said he had the piston out there somewhere that had all the marks and stuff in there. And I was like, I should, I'd love to be able to get it from you, buy it from you, whatever. And I don't even know where he was. But I had seen the piston. It was all marked up and everything. And everyone was just shocked when they took it off. They just thought it was just a standard seizure, which those bikes would do, easily in those days.
Yeah,
and it was very tricky because, we used to start the bikes all in a big pack. And we'd actually make one big lap around the oval before we went in. And so the early laps of that was very difficult because, you can imagine drafting one bike. Sometimes you might be in a draft of 10 or 12 bikes, off of there. In the drafting, you literally could over rev the bikes easily. And I was kind of in this big, it was very buffeting, trying to go around the banking and things with riders. And I just thought it was just a kind of a conventional seizure, but I knew it was still going to put me out of the race if I went into the pits.
And you had to win, so.
Yeah, and I knew I had to win, absolutely. Yeah. And so they really, and I think maybe if I didn't have that overwhelming, confidence and that feeling, that I probably just would have felt, well, my bike seized and I'm going in, But it was the biggest mental conflicts of my life, I knew. It was this feeling. I said I had only a few times, but it had served me well from there. So I stuck with it, and I just felt I had to stay on the racetrack. And so I just kind of angled to the right and went down on the apron down towards the start finish line. And I literally went by the guy who at the flagman and start finish line. Probably going by then maybe only 60 miles an hour, but I was downshifting trying to get the bike running, and then I finally got it into turn one, and then from then it just took off, and that was running pretty good, so it all worked out great. But it was an amazing race, because it was just, I mean, they're all, I go to Daytona, I've been every year since like the 60s, and every year, but it was that year, it was so amazing, because I mean, it was all these things were happening, and I was from about 10th, and then the seizure, I was back to, I don't know, 30th or so, was all the time I lost, getting it back up to speed. And I started working my way up in the pack, and then there was riders were crashing, and the big 750s were going out, and pretty soon, they had the big the leaderboard at Daytona, and all of a sudden, I don't know, maybe a little before the halfway mark, I was in this race with Phil Reed, and pretty soon, I think it was the first five numbers crept up on the leaderboard at Daytona, and all of a sudden, 25 came up, and wow. And I realized we'd come all the way up, through there, and then from my crash the day before, it was kind of sore, but all of a sudden the energy started kind of coming out, and so it was an exciting day.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's a great story.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, and you're involved with the Riders for Health.
I am.
Here in America?
Yeah, I'm just a volunteer, but I've been a friend of, a lot of people who have been very supportive. Randy, of course, I've known him for years and years, and, people like Kenny Roberts and Eddie Lawson and Wayne Rainey and a lot of people, and so I've known all the guys through the years, and they've all been very supportive of it, and so I've stepped up to be, I'm the co-chairman of what they call the affiliate groups, which means all of the, trying to gather up the volunteers to support them here in the U.S., and so we're doing fundraisers and working with dealers here like Carrie here at Tri-Valley Moto, and doing, and actually then the whole thing at Laguna Seca, we'd love to have people come out on Thursday at Laguna Seca is in the afternoon, at 4 o'clock there's going to be an auction for great memorabilia, and we'll have MotoGP riders there, and it's a lot of people think that all the action kind of starts on Friday, but Thursday there'll be some great things happening, and I've heard that Yamaha's now putting together a kart race, a big kart challenge. I think it was on Cycle News. I think I saw something the other day about it. And there, it's going to be Kenny Roberts Sr. and Eddie Lawson and Wayne Rainey and Valentino Rossi are going to race.
Oh my God!
Are going to race a go kart challenge thing. I think about 3:30 in the afternoon. Thursday at Laguna Seca, and then our auction is going to follow just that. So it's, we're thrilled to have now something really exciting happening there. So
that's great.
So there'll be really be a reason for people to come down there on Thursday.
They did the kart race in 2005.
Yeah, remember when Eddie and Wayne were winning everything?
It was, it was really fun seeing the 34 going around.
Yeah.
You know,
but Rossi is going to be in it this year.
That's
Kenny,
funny.
And Kenny.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so now there's really going to be a good reason to come down in our auction to raise funds for our Riders for Health. We'll just follow right after that. So. In the infield there.
Kenny's going to have to do some boot camp or something like that.
I think he's going to have to. I don't know. He shouldn't, because Wayne and Eddie are there and goes in those carts all the time.
I don't know
how much Valley does, but Kenny, he better step it up, because I think Eddie's won some very big races, and Wayne does.
Yeah, it's
good too. So yeah, Laguna Seca's coming up. It's going to be great. I go every year, and it's going to
me too.
It's going to be a great
weekend. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So I hope all you guys come out. So Thursday's would be a great day to come out. And said 4 o'clock we'll have this auction. And, you know, last year I know we had Marco Melandri and Ben Spies and Toslin and Colin Edwards and a lot of the guys. We're going to try to get all of them to come over. You know, Rossi, we'll try to get all of them over to our areas in turn 4 and right in the little paddock area out there. So.
And we also get to do a tour of the track on bikes, right?
Yeah, well, that would, if people sign up for the big ticket, you know, where they, if it's free to come to just observe the auction.
But the
ticket, the whole $500 package is a thing which people can buy and everything. There's a ride down to Carmel in the morning. You come back. There's a lap around the track you get to take. There's going to be a garage tour of the MotoGP pits and everything. It's a thing. And there's a whole thing, actually, Day of Stars. .net on the website, people can look up the information about that's called Day of Stars.
I'll put all that stuff in our show notes, which have all the links and stuff like that. So
great, that'd
people
be great.
Be able to get
yeah,
to
but
it.
That's a very worthwhile ticket with all the profits and things going to Riders for Health.
So. That's fantastic. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, and it was good to meet you.
Okay, glad to be here.
All right.
Thanks.
Ciao.
Okay. Thanks, Jules.
All right. Got Jules on the phone. How are you doing today, Jules?
I'm doing good. Just did a track day with Liam and our buddy Jay at Thunderhill. It was really a lot of fun.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because you texted me from, you know, like Sunday night there and said, you know, that's awesome that you got there the night before. The weather was beautiful. And I didn't get a lot of update about how the track day was. I saw you post a bunch of pictures, some awesome photos up there, certainly on Facebook and probably on your website. What else happened? I mean, good stuff.
It was just great watching just how ridiculously geeky Liam is working on his bike.
Really?
That bike was perfect. They made me wash my wheels. That was horrible.
Oh, so geeky in an anal everything must be clean way? Is that what you're saying?
Nerdy, geeky, incredible. Like, you know, he had a mechanical problem during his first session. He fixed it like right there with some super glue. That was great.
Nice. So, is this stuff that Liam picked up in working in MotoGP, that the bike must be clean?
I'm pretty sure that he was always like that, and that's the reason why he got a job in MotoGP.
Ah, you good know. Point. Yeah, egg, chicken, etc.
Yep.
But in any case, though, Thunderhill, you had a good time.
Good stuff. Very good stuff. You know, I broke some bogeys that I had on that track. I never really had that much confidence in the back straights there, and I was really just fine this time around. Got a lot of good advice from Jim.
Was Jim there with you?
No. But we talked on the phone, and he's raced there, you know, many times. He's an AFM guy, so he had some good pointers.
Yeah. What were, just out of curiosity, in the backstreet, what were your bogeys a little bit on Thunderhill? Because we have a lot of guys there.
Yeah,
Thunderhill's a cool track.
Well, I just always had trouble staying on the gas through 8. Going into 8 and staying through all the way, you know, and this time around...
8 is the long sweeper that's a long left-handed sweeper leading up to 9, obviously.
Which goes up the hill, yeah.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
There's a dip in the middle, which kind of is scary, and, you know, and it looks a lot tighter than it really is. So it took me a long time, and I was going through there. Basically, I was using my rev limiter as a braking marker for 9.
Nice.
In fourth gear, and this time around, I was going up to 5th, so yeah, it was good. It's good stuff.
And you read the duck, or did you ride the SV?
No, I wore the duck, definitely. It was the duck daddy, like you wouldn't believe. It was completely covered with duct tape. It was pretty
It's crash prepped. So.
Yeah.
Now, Thunder Hill's an excellent track. I'm looking forward to going down there with PSSR in, I think it's November this year.
Oh, man, it's late. But still,
yeah,
I'm sure
it is a little late.
Out there, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, it'll be fine. Good weather. Last year was a bit of a rain out, but we still had a good time. But this year, I'm looking forward to a really, really good track day. And that might be the only track the Amanu we will do this year.
Definitely join you for that one. So
good. Yes, yep. You have to. So you and Darren and Fergus and I will all get together on that, and we'll make sure that we have it organized of what we're going to do and all of that, because a two-day doubleheader for PSSR. And it's always so much fun. It's an excellent track. So I'm glad you had a good time, Jules. That's awesome. I'm glad you didn't crash, too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's always a plus. So, all right. So good thing you had a good track day. Glad you got to talk to Liam. Did you give him a hard time about his entertaining impression of you?
No. I didn't have a chance because they kept bugging me about my wheels.
Yeah. Oh, great. More hard time. Well, one of these days you'll have to do your own Liam impression, and we can talk about what that consists of. Liam, if you're listening, when you least expect it. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about motorcycle racing. Didn't have anything last week much, but we've got Catalunya coming up this weekend, which is another one of those tracks where it's like, you know, MotoGP at Catalunya. Wow. You know, maybe not quite as guaranteed of an exciting race as Mugello is, but still something about Catalunya is very enticing, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, 2007, I was thinking about, like, that was probably the most interesting race of 2007, where Stoner kind of walked away with a championship. That was an incredible race with him and Rossi and Pedrosa, and we've had some runaways there, but it's good. It's a good racetrack. We've had good races there, and we've had some surprises there before. So
I think exactly. Another thing about Catalunya is the high trap speed. If you recall, a few years ago, this is where Danny Pedrosa broke 200 miles an hour. It was kind of big news and this and that. I mean, this is a fast track.
Oh yeah,
definitely. So that one should be kind of interesting as far as what's going to happen on that front, because we just saw him set a new record for MotoGP at Mugello.
That's Dan right. Pedrosa,
what was it, 217?
217, like, yeah.
217. And insanely fast. If you can imagine going 217 miles an hour on a motorcycle, you know, 340 kilometers or whatever the hell it is an hour, it's like, oh, my God. And so I was kind of a little bit wondering how that is going to work out as far as what's going to happen in Catalunya.
Yeah.
Because we don't have World Supers taking a week off. They're getting back into the, it looks like a little bit for a while, alternate weekends.
Yep.
Because they don't have Misano until the following weekend. So it makes it a little easier to watch that way. You don't have everything deluged down you in one weekend.
Right.
It's a little difficult. So, all right. Other stuff coming up about Catalunya. What do we got? We got Sid Gibernau coming back.
So, both Danny and Gibernau coming back. Both kind of surprising. Gibernau news came out earlier this week and that he was coming back. And just 2 days ago, or even yesterday, I think Pedrosa said he's going to be there.
And I was a little surprised about that one.
Me too.
After reading up on his injuries and all of that, it's like, that sounds extraordinarily painful.
Yeah, no, he's riding with some serious injections if he's going to ride.
Right.
They even
had
an article about that. Like, he likes the injections.
Well, great. So Pooj is not only sort of molding Pedrosa to be his own little puppet, but he's making him into a junkie as well. So... Pedrosa, what do you think that's going to do for his weekend?
I don't know, actually. You mean like being
having, he's going to be stoned basically out there.
Well,
so,
you know, I mean, it's localized stuff.
Yeah, it is. I know. And I'm making light of it, but seriously though, he's riding with a bit of a handicap or
totally.
Exactly. So, I mean, are we going to see Pedrosa? And I mean, we haven't been the biggest Pedrosa fans on this show in the past, but I think that both you and I have acknowledged that the guy's got talent.
And balls.
I was just going to say, I think he's got a fair amount of balls. He really does. And so are we going to be seeing him up there? Okay, real quick. Pedrosa top five, yes, no.
Do you want to do this? Because I actually have thought about it, and I think that Pedrosa is going to surprise us. I think he could be in top four.
Wow.
I'm putting him fourth in my predictions.
Excellent. I do want to do predictions. I just wanted to throw that one out there early on as sort of a news related story as much as anything. But I think that's kind of cool, and I'm glad that you're talking about that.
Because, you know, when he's on, he's 100%, he's really tough to beat in this track. You know, he's not going to be 100%, but who knows? We'll know it at practice, but we're doing these predictions right now, so I'm going to just throw it out there and say he can do top five.
We don't have to do these predictions right now if you're not ready, Jules. I didn't want to.
Oh, yeah, let's start. Let's do it on Friday. Yeah. No, I meant we're doing the predictions on Wednesday instead of
with
no information about what he looks like when he's actually on the track.
I think it's going to be interesting stuff. And to be honest with you, from the news that I have read, if the guy wasn't Spanish, if this wasn't Catalunya, I would say he probably wouldn't even race.
Exactly. He's going to do everything to be there. And it's same thing with Gibernau. Think about Gibernau.
Yeah.
Gibernau, this is the reason why Gibernau was out since 2006. I mean, he has not actually completed a lap at Catalunya since 2005.
Oh, wow. That's true.
Because in 2006, he crashed at the very start and had that horrible crash, you know. That was the beginning of his retirement, really. You know, he was there for a while longer, but that was the beginning.
Good point. And I do think that Gibernau has accelerated any recovery that he is going through in order to make it for Catalunya. Mm-hmm. But like I said in a previous show, I think the guy's getting used to broken collarbones. I mean, the thing is in about, I don't know how many pieces. And so,
stick the damn thing out.
Yeah. Put a rod in there. You know, but so if you know, I kind of figured, you know, Gibernau had a little more time, and not a lot of time, but a little more time to heal up and everything. I wasn't too surprised to see that he's going to be making it for Catalunya. Pedrosa, I have to admit, I was a little surprised.
Oh, I'm very surprised, but at the same time, like reading about it and seeing a couple of photos of him smiling, maybe they're out of the archive, but. he looks confident for somebody who just is coming off of a bad injury.
Yeah, and that injury was so weird too. Actually, the fracture your thigh without even crashing, just because your butt torqued so much.
Well, no, I think he dislocated himself there, and then the fracture was actually from the crash in the race.
I thought he fractured it during.
Maybe you're right. Yeah.
Well. Whatever it was. He was basically injured going into the race without a real fall. He injured himself on an almost high side, kind of torque things, and it sounded really nasty just reading the news. Like tearing muscle away from bone, and I'm like cringing.
You know, the thing is, like, if you look at him in like street clothes, that guy is like anorexic. You know, not only is he short, he's really, really freaking skinny. So I'm not surprised that he's pretty brittle, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Drink more milk or something like that, and he needs to get something going on. Build strong bones.
Yeah. Or stick some steroids, I don't know.
It's something, you know, anything would help at this point. Because I do, you know, we've talked about this in past shows, but I worry a little bit about that he's burning the candle at both ends, basically.
Yeah.
Because he's still pretty young. How old is Pedrosa?
He's 23.
Yeah. So, I mean, relatively young in a MotoGP sense of the word and still got some time ahead of him. But if, you know, if he screws himself up where it's just a bag full of injuries, that's not good. And that's not going to be a championship winning formula.
Yeah.
Let's see. That kind of covers that aspect of things of the injured riders riding in at Catalunya. Do you want to jump into the predictions, or do you want to talk about some of the other news we got about Catalunya?
Well, is there any other news? Well, I guess the tire stuff. So let's cover that first.
Right. Exactly. The tire stuff, and that was the news that I had on my notes of what's going on with Catalunya. Because Bridgestone has said that they're going to be bringing the dual compound, the asymmetrical tire.
They've been running dual compounds. Just you're talking about, yeah, exactly right. Where the right side of the tire is softer,
significantly
harder,
softer.
Actually, I think or
one side is softer than the other. And
if it's a right hand track, you'd probably want it to be a little bit harder on the right side.
And now I'm having to look it up. But one way or the other, one side they're running the like super hard. And yep. The hard at Catalunya, right? But on all of these tires, they're putting the offside tire, or offside of the tire, is the softer compound, simply because there's so many more...
Right-hand turns.
You're killing me, right-hand turns.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. And this is the kind of thing that I've always said is beneficial to motorcycle tires in general. Multiple compounds, whether or not it's, crazy asymmetrical, one side is rock hard, one side is bowling ball soft, or no, not bowling ball soft, but super soft.
Yeah, bowling ball, soft bowling balls, yeah.
Soft bowling balls. that sort of thing, which what we're doing at Catalunya, apparently, where one side is really hard and one side is quite soft. Or whether it's just a more graduated thing, like the Michelin Pilot tires that you can buy right now, the dual compounds, they're amazing tires.
Yeah, no,
and my
Bridgestone BTO2s are the dual compound too.
Exactly.
The thing is that I think that the really amazing stuff that Bridgestone has done is when they actually do have the massive differences in compounds, because when it's gradual, I think that, I don't know. I mean, the manufacturing process for this stuff is insane, but like you've seen tires this year, especially this year, where the wear patterns are just really crazy. Like you see everything kind of looking good, and then all of a sudden, just ripped.
Chunk City, yeah.
And then there was a chunk that came out of Rossi's tire in 2006 that just, obviously a section of the center tire was just came out from in between the other compounds. So the tire wasn't, completely glued together, whatever they do. Yeah, it's amazing technology, and they may be using asymmetric on some of these tracks, but the technology that they're developing to be able to build that kind of tire eventually does trickle down to us.
Exactly, and although the trickle down in a street tire might be very, very gradual, if you translate it into MotoGP tires, it's like the medium to the medium rare, right on the side.
Sure.
But whereas here that we're talking quite a severe transition. But the more they learn about making that a tire that can withstand that severe transition from hard to soft, and how do you bond these two sets of rubber together? They're learning stuff, and that's good for us.
Yeah, I would actually buy an asymmetric tire and do my commute with. Go across the Bay Bridge, then across the I would go across the Golden Gate, then across the Richmond Bridge, and I would always be just doing a right hand circle. So there you go.
Do you ever see in the near future Bridgestone selling a truly asymmetrical tire? You want this for this commute, but you want this other tire for that commute. Do you see that happening, Jules?
No.
But if they can learn about the general technology of building a tire, a better tire that's like hard in the center and soft on the sides. And this is what MotoGP is all about. And I think. So I think it's a cool thing. So I thought that was exciting news that we read that they're bringing these, super asymmetrical tires for Catalunya, which is traditionally a very hard tire track. This track is hard on tires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it gets hot there too.
Yes, it does. Although, unfortunately, I believe rain is forecast.
Yes,
last
again,
I checked.
I know.
I know.
I think I'm going to just,
It's getting crazy. I said last weekend I was done. I've had my, we had Le Mans, we had Mugello with this sort of semi-wet, dry business. I don't want any more of it. And I really hope they don't have that at Catalunya.
Yeah, me too.
What else we got going on as far as news for Catalunya? I didn't really see a lot of major breaking stories.
Let's just go to the predictions.
Yeah, let's jump right into that. So, Catalunya.
Want to go last to first, maybe?
You want to try that? You're throwing me a loop here, but I will adapt and I will overcome and I will figure it out.
Who's going to be last?
Nicola Canepa.
Okay, me too.
That's not cool after Mugello. You were supposed to give him...
I know, but Mugello is a track that he's been at many times.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Now I got to figure out how many lines down on my pad to write my predictions to 18-ish.
18, because okay. we got Zubin now. So.
I know, yes. So Nicola Canepa, we're picking for last, which, sorry, Nicola, but that's the way life is. And second to last.
17th. I'm going to say Zubin now.
Wow, really?
Okay. Yeah, I would love to see him finish up higher, but I just have a feeling that he's going to struggle big time.
And this is going to sound super, super lame, but off the top of your head, what's Gibernau's number? Because I don't have it right in front of me.
Gibernau?
What's he running this year?
59?
Is it 59? Okay.
Or something like that?
Well, I'm just going to write Jib. That's sad. Okay. And I actually, well, that's your prediction. I wasn't going to necessarily put Gibernau down that low.
So then don't.
Yeah, I'm not. And I was going to say at that point that I'd probably be seeing Nikki Kallio.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So you for number 16.
Yes, so it is 59. I'm going to go with Kallio.
Okay. And I will go with Nikki Hayden.
Ooh.
I know. Brutal. And as a fan, it hurts me. But it's the way it is. Okay. Let's see. 15th spot.
I'm going to say Takahashi.
I'm having to make this up on the fly. I probably should have put Takahashi before Hayden, but whatever. Yeah, I'm going to go with Takahashi as well.
All right, I put Hayden 14th. I want him in the points.
I'd love to see Hayden in the points. I need to see Hayden in the points. I hope I'm wrong. I hope Hayden finishes top 10, but I don't think it's going to happen. You know, hope, think, different things. Yep. All right, so cool deal. We're up to what?
14th.
14th spot. Catalonia, 14th spot. Oh boy, you're getting down into the now. You're starting to have to make decisions and everything else. I would not be too surprised if I was going to pick the 14th rider. I would go with James Toseland.
Okay, that's fair. He's done well this track before, but he had a decent. I mean, he had a good race at Mugello. If it's a dry race, I think he will probably finish further down in the order. If it's a mixed race, he may again benefit from like an early switch or something like that. So yeah, that's probably a good call. All right, 13th. I'm gonna put DeAngelis.
Wait, are you putting Toseland 14th as well?
No, I put Hayden 14th.
Okay. So DeAngelis 13th for you. Okay, yep. And that makes sense. Actually, he was going to be sort of my next victim of bottom third finishers.
Right.
So I'll go with DeAngelis in 13th spot for me.
Okay. I'm going to go with Toseland in 12th.
Wait, who'd you have for 13th?
DeAngelis.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So you got Toseland.
I'm trying to keep up. I'm sorry. We're going backwards. You're confusing me, Jules.
Okay, now we go to pick 7th.
Then 7th?
Then pick 10th. No, okay.
Wait a minute. I'm still working on 12.
All right.
So, 12th spot. Oh, Randy DePugna.
Okay. I think Elias will be 11th. I think Elias really wants to do well this track, but something is holding him back big time. And I don't know what it is, but certainly if he really truly has a factory bike, then the Vizioso and Pedrosa have proven that bike can compete for the top 5. So, you know, something else is up with Elias. Maybe his riding style is not fitting very well with the Bridgestones. I mean, he's been on the Bridgestones since last year, so that's not really a good excuse. So, yeah, it's kind of a bummer. But, I'm putting him in 11th.
Okay, that sounds fair. And I'm going to go with, same, Elias.
Okay.
And yeah,
10th. It was painful, but I'm going to put Melandri.
I'm putting Vermeulen.
Vermeulen?
Yeah. But you're right. Melandri's a good pick, an excellent pick.
The thing is that, you know, it's another track like Mugello. If it rains, it equalizes him and he'll do better. But that track just requires a lot of horses and stuff that he doesn't really have access to yet.
And that's part of the reason why is that I was kind of thinking that it's going to be a rainy race, just because simply because Wednesday night is recording this. This is forecast. But even if it is a rainy race, I'm wondering, I think that the Kawasaki Hayate motorcycle day in the sun is done. And just a hunch.
Maybe. I'm actually, you know, this Catalunya is important for another reason, which is because they're going to have a test immediately after
right.
the race. And it's going to be very interesting to see if these results that Melandri has been getting have woken anybody up. And maybe he's going to get a little gift. We'll see.
Possibly. I certainly hope so. And also, I think that back to Hayden real quick, you know, way back down that I put him in, you know, what, 16th, that I think he's going to learn a lot and mold and meld with this motorcycle, because that's one of the things he's suffering from is lack of test time.
Yeah.
I really do think that you know, this guy is, he's the consummate let's ride some laps kind of guy. And testing is where you go out and do that. And he's always been the guy that goes out there and rides, you know, huge numbers of laps.
90 laps, you know.
Right, when the other guys are doing like 30.
Right.
And, you know, so it's just, I think that he'll make the most of the Catalunya. And we might see, after Catalunya, this hope for Hayden of things are blending together. You know, new crew chief, it's getting together with a bike,
and
whatever
and
it is.
Tracks that he likes too coming up.
That's true too. That is big time true. But are they tracks that are suited to the Ducati?
Yeah, well, he's going to Assen. Assen is great for the Ducati. He's really good at Assen. So
okay.
Yeah, I could see that. And then he's going to go to Laguna after that.
Right. When we low, he loves Laguna. But Laguna, yeah. but it's
Laguna.
Just Laguna.
Nice.
Yeah, there is no NA in Laguna. But whether or not is that going to really suit his riding style and the Ducati, et cetera,
Laguna? Well, we'll have plenty of time to talk about that.
Unfortunately, we won't, because I'm going to be gone, dude.
Oh, shit. So that's right.
You and I are not going to be talking about that much. We will be talking about it at the track. And we'll get to that later, folks. All right, let's go back farther, moving on up our finishing order. 9th spot.
Vermeulen.
You got Vermeulen, and I am thinking I am going to go... I'm going on a limb here, and I'm going to with Edwards.
Okay. Okay. Just out of the blue, or what?
That is actually a little out of the blue.
Okay.
But I just don't think that some of the results. I don't think you can classify this year's results with Edwards. He's a little bit like the random number generator that we saw a few years ago with Melandri, and I think the tires are giving him more trouble than he wants to admit.
I agree. But I think so. I think that it's going to be totally dependent on the weather.
Yes.
I mean, for him, much more than almost anybody else, because we know that in the wet, he sucks on the Bridgestones.
Right.
He really sucks. He's going to be down like in 14th if it's full rain.
If it's full rain, I'm kind of banking that Catalunya, come on, it's late June.
Yeah.
Or mid-June. I'm thinking that it'll be a somewhat of a wet-dry race. And so you're going to get this pit strategy falling in and all other kind of crap that we don't really like in MotoGP, but it will affect. And I'm trying to bring that a little bit into my predictions.
Okay.
And I really don't see Colin Edwards finishing any higher than 9th.
Okay. That's good.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to say for 8th, Depunier.
RDP, who has been having an amazing season this year.
Yeah, because he's
Randy.
Been staying on the bike.
Exactly what I was getting at. All right, I'm putting Melandri in 8.
Melandri, got it. Good for you. I should be putting it higher. Okay, 7th, Caparossi.
Good choice, and actually, I agree with you. I think that's excellent. I'm not excellent for Caparossi, but an excellent pick of where he will end up.
Cool.
Wow, we've got some names going on that we have not yet picked.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and
Where are you going to put Pedrosa?
I know, I'm running out of room.
We're in sixth.
I'm thinking
now.
That I will put Pedrosa in sixth.
I'm going to put Edwards in sixth.
Okay. And I didn't count enough lines down on my pad either, so I'm having to squish it in two lines. I guess we're going back top to front. So, fifth spot. Yes, indeed.
I'm going to go with Dovi.
I think Dovi's an excellent choice for fifth spot because I don't think he's quite cut the chops for anything higher than that, basically.
Well, there you go.
There you go. So that leaves us down with the last four. So
so you're missing somebody. You haven't done Gibbernau yet, that's why.
Oh, Gibbernau has to be in my top four? No, that's not going to work.
No.
So I have to scooch some numbers up here. Okay. And thank you very much for bringing that up for me. I'm going to put Gibbernau in at eighth.
Really?
And I'm going to scoot everybody else up.
Okay. So Melandri in seventh.
Right. Caparossi in sixth.
Pedrosa fifth. And
Pedrosa
Dovi
fifth now.
Fourth.
And Dovi fourth. And
okay.
Well,
I hope that you're right for Gibbernau's sake. I don't think he's going to get any points, but...
Be honest with you, that's a little bit of an emergency fix.
You didn't want to look too many names up.
Yeah. Okay. I forgot Gibbernau.
All right, let's so I have Pedrosa fourth, you have Dovi fourth. Let's do the podium. Because
yeah, the podium. That's the most important part. That's the part where it's like, you know, this really counts, the podium. And so, all right, go ahead, Jules.
So last year, Lorenzo didn't get to finish the race because he didn't even get to finish qualifying because he had that nasty concussion and he was not allowed to ride.
That one doesn't count.
And, you know, so we don't know how he does on a MotoGP 800 bike, but I have a feeling that he's going to be very, very strong here. Rossi has been very strong here, obviously. And Stoner has been very strong here, although he didn't win last year. But he did win in 2007, like I was saying earlier, with a very, very good battle against both Pedrosa and Rossi. I think Stoner coming off of Mugello is a bit of a boost, but it's a toss-up between those three guys.
See, okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here because I screwed up already with my order and forgot Gibbernau, so I feel that I should go out on a limb first.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you why. And I am going to go with, for the win, Jorge Lorenzo.
Mm-hmm.
Second place, Stoner. Third place, Rossi. And I think this is true because... Lorenzo last year's race, it didn't count. So we didn't get to see exactly what Lorenzo's going to do on the bike, Catalunya and all that. Sure. This is Spain. He's going to be out there. He's going to want to win. The other guy that I would say would be insanely wanting to win out here is obviously Pedrosa. But because of his injury, you know, that's why I'm putting him way back down.
Yeah. I would have put Pedrosa in for the win if it wasn't coming out the injury.
Right, exactly. So I'm going to go with Lorenzo for the win. But I think that the Ducati in Stoner's hands, that he can beat Rossi. And this is a race I want to see. And I'm hoping that we will see it.
That it won't be a train. It'll be actual race.
Right, that it'll be a battle and all that good stuff. And so I think that Lorenzo is going to check out. And that Rossi and Stoner are going to battle. And that Stoner will win.
Cool. All right. I'm going to go with Stoner to win, Rossi second, and Lorenzo third. And
okay.
I think it's because I think Stoner has got the momentum. I really think he is the most talented rider outside of Rossi. You know what? That's not true. I don't. Actually, to be honest, I think Lorenzo is incredibly talented. But what I saw at Mugello was that Rossi's pace was good enough to catch Lorenzo. And, I mean, it's a very different track, and it's a track that obviously plays into Rossi's hands the way that Catalunya will play into Lorenzo's hands. But look at what happened to Jerez with Lorenzo. And I think that Rossi's starting to identify Lorenzo as the bigger threat than Stoner. And it might actually give Stoner the advantage because Rossi's going to be concentrating on beating Lorenzo. I think he really wants to beat him. I'm putting him second as a gift, and I really want him to win, but... But I don't think it's going to happen.
also, on the other hand, though, I see Lorenzo being so hungry and crazy for this win. Now, Rossi's also going to be hungry and crazy.
He's got to.
But, I know. It's going to be a good race. I'm getting really excited just talking about it right here.
Good. That's the whole point.
Yeah. Catalunya is not necessarily my favorite track as far as layout is concerned. But as far as overall MotoGP experience, coolness, race is concerned, it's definitely up there as far as a really cool track.
And it's got a really good mix of stuff on the track. There are some good technical, very technical sections. There's sections where the bike gets to show off. There's sections where the rider gets to show off. I think it's a really good track. So are we done? Are we done with Catalunya?
I think we're done. We're done. Yeah.
Okay. Well, actually, there was also the Dunnington story, right?
Right. Finally got homologated.
Yeah. So BSB, World Superbikes, and MotoGP get to do their rounds. Yay. I mean, this is a very important market.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You know, so for all those series, I mean, obviously, BSB is going to have races elsewhere, so it's not as critical, but it's such a, you know, well-known venue.
It's a round that they have to have. You know what I mean? It's a crown sort
of exactly, thing. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's every series goes there. So, you know,
right. If BSB doesn't go there, it's going to look kind of funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, the thing is that I think that, you know, like I said, I think it was a bluff because those, the owners of the land, what the hell are they going to do with it if there's no motorcycle racing that year?
Right. Exactly. You know, how many club car races are you going to have? Not to knock club car racing, but...
Well, no, even that would be difficult to do because they would have to find somebody else to actually run the track because that the lease is for everything, including those track days. You know, and club races and stuff.
But also part of it, at Donington, was it not that it had to be sanctioned by the FIM?
Right.
Right. Yep. Because there was some runoff issues and all this sort of thing. They had changed some of the layout. Yeah. And, you know, so we had this big mystery of, is the FIM going to, you know, actually say Donington is okay? And, I mean, all the MotoGP writers have always said that Donington, as far as facilities, is pretty much crap.
Right.
And as runoff...
But as a racetrack, it's you know, beloved by the racers.
Right, exactly.
They love it.
And even as far as runoff is concerned, it's got its pluses and minuses. But they moved a wall in somewhere on one of the corners, and that was a problem. So they had to fix that.
Anyway, it's good that they're saving this round, because imagine if they had lost yet another round this year. That would have been a disaster.
Tragic.
So I think no matter what, this round was going to happen, you know, where even maybe heads would roll, like almost literally, this round was not going to be canceled. So,
and exactly, that was my feeling when this news came out. Is like, there's no way this is going to happen.
Yeah,
because it is a historic track, and it's actually sad that MotoGP is not scheduled to go there beyond what
next year. Actually,
yeah, next year, exactly. So, you know, Silverstone's comparatively a snooze fest as far as track layout is concerned, compared to Donington. So it's a little bit sad.
Well, the other news from England was that, well, not England, but that region is, you know, Alaman has started, and Agostini and Rossi rode there on Monday. And there's a photo, actually, somebody took of Rossi following Agostini, and Rossi's like fully... both wheels are in the air on an R1 doing one of the laps. He had some funny comments about it, of course, afterwards, you know, like just amazed at how crazy the passing is at that track, the road on that road. And of course the other news that I've been following, is the, zero emissions race. So they had their first practice.
Right. The TTX GP.
Yeah, that's the XGP. Yeah, the first practice, and there was one bike that was like just way ahead of the rest in terms of top speed and overall. I think it was in a trap. It was at 102 miles an hour. That was the speed, the max speed, and it did an 84.8 mile per hour average speed. You know, not terrible. The thing is, the rest of the bikes were like way, way slower. Like we're talking like 70 or 67 miles per hour average. And it was funny because they did an interview with a couple of the riders, and one of the riders was like, you know, I've been racing here for so long, I didn't realize how nice the scenery is.
But on the other hand, I mean, you know, we make fun of it a little bit, but this is also one of the areas where racing is paying its debt to society and developing.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, hell, these guys, they're 10 out of the 14 bikes finished the lap. That's incredible. Think about that. They're motorcycles that are carrying their own batteries, their own power supplies. It's not like they're sitting on a dyno like that MotoGP video where they're attached to gigantic batteries. These guys have them mounted on the bike, and they are completing an almost 40-mile-an-hour course at, you know, speeds that we – above our commute speeds. So all that stuff is good. All that stuff is really, really good.
Exactly.
Well, it's just, by the way, did not finish their lap. They had, I don't know what happened, but they didn't even get to the halfway point.
Right, which is a shame.
Yeah. I'm guessing that the iPod that they have mounted in the – I don't know if – have you seen the photos of it?
I saw some photos. I didn't see an iPod.
But no, they actually use – they're using an iPod for their display.
Are they really?
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, the digital superbike is what it's called, and they stuck the iPod in there. I thought that was very clever. And maybe they just needed the firmware upgrade that came out today.
I'm a little skeptical. So, when you say 70 average, you've got to pass all those pubs and trees and cottages and walls and all of that thing at a relatively slow speed. That means that a lot of your time is spent going really fast.
Well, so there is, I mean, they in the traps, they were, you know, nobody else came even close to the Rob Barber on the Agni Motors Team Agni bike. He had he had 102. I think the next best speed through the trap was like in the low 90s. So I think these bikes have such a completely different characteristics that, like, there's actually audio commentary that I listened to on the blog ttxgp.com. They were saying, like, some of those bikes really cooked out of the corners much faster than anybody expected. Like, they just have really amazing torque and acceleration, which is, you know, that's understandable. It's an electric motor. So I think that they actually were able to keep some of the sections probably at a reasonable pace compared to the gas-powered bikes. It's just that on the top-end sections is where they really petered out.
Right, because they're carrying around 100-pound batteries. I mean, and but this is – it's also a learning curve.
It is, and the guys from Agni said, you know, these are the guys, they're definitely sandbagging. And he said his own team said that they still had 15% battery power left, which is, you know, pretty significant. That means that the rider can next time around – I mean, this is just the first practice, right? They haven't even started qualifying yet. So the rider may be able to, like, you know – squeeze a little bit more power out of it. But it's very interesting because I think, you know, in 5 years these bikes are going to start hitting the market, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens and just how, I mean, I would love to have a torquey bike like that with no transmission to go back and forth to work on, you know.
What about the sound? Everybody goes on about the sound. What do you know about the sound, Joel?
Well, they sound so freaking cool. They sound like TIE fighters. They sound great.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good comparison. Yeah.
And the writer, there were a bunch of writers that were saying, you know, with the wind noise and stuff like that, you don't really hear your own motor. I mean, obviously,
no.
For us, we do because we don't go that fast. But at higher speeds, you don't. It's true. Like, even on the track,
it blends into a white noise sort of a sound. Yeah. I agree.
You feel the motor more than you hear it. The thing that they all across the board were complaining about was there's no engine braking at all.
No, yeah, there wouldn't be none. Yeah.
And I'm thinking that there's probably going to be somebody who's going to say, you know what, I'm going to recapture some of that energy slowing down and, you know, recharge the batteries some, not just through the brakes, but through the motor, and give the rider some engine braking in that way, you know. So, but that's very tricky.
So, cool. All right, Jules, we will talk to you again later, and actually in a couple of weeks, because I will be gone, and good luck with the show, And we'll talk to you again in July, and looking forward to Laguna Seca on July 4th weekend.
Fantastic. All right. Well, have fun, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Fun. It's capital F.
All right. Ciao.
Bye.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. You're listening to MotoGP OD. My name is Jim Race, and on the line, I have Sean Harris, multi-time TT winner from New Zealand. How are you doing this afternoon, Sean?
Very good, thank you, Mike. Very good indeed.
Yeah. How's the weather on the island today? It's Sunday, June 7th. I'm sorry.
Right at this very minute in time, I could take all my clothes off, run around naked, and be very, very comfortable and warm. It's a lovely day, but I don't think the nakedness would be too good.
Yeah, it is a mad Sunday, or semi-mad Sunday with no racing, I guess, but even the local bobbies would probably leave you alone running around naked there today.
Yes, I think they're preoccupied just making sure that everybody's being as safe as possible over here.
Great. How many have you done any laps this the first week of the fortnight around the track, either on a bike, or I'm assuming in the car, of course, but on a bike?
No, I'm not a road rider at all. I never ride on the road full stop. The only time I get on a motorbike is to go racing. Actually, that's a lie. I do some very brief test riding in the country in the area where I live in New Zealand for customer motorcycles that I work on. But basically, I'm not a road rider. I'm a racer only. I don't ride on the roads. Too many cars out there that are ignoramus and don't realize that a motorbike's skinny and goes fast.
You know, I think you and I have an awful lot of, like, I swore off any road riding about 10 years ago, and the only time I will get on a bike is when I'm on a racetrack and everybody's going in, you know, sort of the same direction.
That's how I look at it as well, Jim, exactly the same. And you asked me, have I done any laps? Yes, I've done a couple of laps in the car, and that was with Jimmy Verlin. Sorry, I can't retain his last name. He's one of the American riders over here racing this year.
Yeah.
I took him around for a couple of nights the other night because he's riding for a friend of mine the person who owns the machine that he's riding is a friend of mine. So, and also some other people in America that helped me out in the past in the Wira racing scene are associated with Jimmy. So I've done what I can to help him out. So yeah, I've done a couple of laps in the car and it was great.
You know, you said something last night, after I briefly spoke with you to set this up, I was doing some research, and one of the things that I came across on YouTube were some fantastic onboard laps that you narrated of the circuit when you were aboard the Britain. One of the comments I remember that you making that stuck in my head from that was that at least then the bikes were about at the same speed. I'm sure they picked up by then, but that you felt that the circuit itself was being smoothed out and made more short circuit light, to the extent where safety would actually possibly be declined because people were able to go faster, easier around the track. Have you seen that get that way more and more?
To be completely honest with you, yes. The track itself is getting faster and faster and faster. I spoke with I won't use his name because I don't have the right to quote for someone else, but I spoke with a rider over here who's a very good friend and has won here many, many times. We were both sitting down the other day having a cup of coffee together. Since 2003, which was the year that I had my two lucky wins here, the track itself is at least 45 seconds a lap quicker than what it was in 2003. Now, what has made it quicker is not necessarily smoothing it out. Because it's a winding country road, effectively, you've got a lot of lack of vision through corners due to trees. So you can enter a corner, but you cannot see the exit due to trees and so forth, hedges and rah, rah, rah. So what's happened is a lot of these hedges and trees have been removed and so forth, so you can actually see through the corner now, so you can treat that corner like a short circuit as such. You can plan it, you can see through it, and you can run. You know, so it's actually aiding people to, with a 37-mile lap, you've only got to make up a second a mile, you've made up 37 seconds, man. And the time that I did in 2003 was 123 and a bit mile an hour on a production bike. Well, the superbikes now are doing 131 miles an hour. When I looked at it before Cameron Donald and Tass Suzuki had cracked 131 mile an hour, my lap of 123 to 130 was only 1 minute, nothing. And not being disrespectful to the man that's going that fast, but the way that I look at it, it really is nothing, because since 2003, machines have got a lot better, tyres have got a lot better, the track's got a lot better. Maybe I'm a little bit arrogant and confident and cocky, but I still see that speed as feasible. And yes, it's very easy to go fast here in 2 to 3 years now if this type of environment suits you. If it doesn't suit you, if it's not your type of environment, excuse me, no, you will not go fast anyway because it's just not your environment. I grew up in this type of environment in Taranaki, New Zealand. It's country lanes, it's country roads, and I rode motorbikes on the road until I was 23 like an absolute idiot. How I'm not dead already, I've no idea. So this is just like being at home to me.
It's funny you say that because, you know, someday you and I will have to sit down over a pint, but I was doing that exact same thing in the Bay Area of Northern California, and essentially I went racing because I was scaring the crap out of myself on the roads, and I said, I got to do something different. I'm either going to die or get thrown in prison. So, you know, and what you say rings true. 1 minute is a very small slice of time over an awful lot of miles. And it's kind of amazing that that is the small difference, but it is just that difference.
Definitely.
Cameron's out. He had a small tip over, well, not a tip over, but hit a bit of a trough in a field on runoff, which may have been safe in the past, or he might even just have missed it, and the guy's out, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame. What actually happened with Cam was effectively the corner that he downshifted going into the turn, and he didn't select – well, he found a false neutral, okay? So nature of that particular turn, there is a – not an escape road. It's not a runoff road. Effectively, it's a country lane, right? If you're out in the country, it's like an entrance to a paddock. And he decided rather than tip into the corner and either A, wash the front, or B, end up hitting a wall, I will run up that road. Now, everything was A, completely in control. He was quite comfortable, but there was a massive, massive, huge bump there, like a undulation in the ground, which is what, which is what actually caused the accident. And unfortunately, he's been injured to the point he has. Now, they have been saying a cracked vertebrae and so forth as well. But I do believe now, unofficially, that that cracked vertebrae is actually an old injury that he had from a couple of years ago. I believe his main issue is really the dislocated shoulder.
And it was interesting because I watched an interview from him yesterday on ITV4 that was recorded, I think, probably Friday, but for ITV4. And they had, you know, him and all the Relentless boys behind him while they're doing the interview. And the first thing that came into my mind was, okay, so they've pushed the weekend off for 2 days. And most of the race is going to happen Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then again on Friday. And the part of the back of his mind must be going, you know, if a couple of days of rest and maybe I can give it a look. But I'm sure the doctors have said no.
No, I have not spoken to the doctors personally, and I haven't, like, I went up to see Cam in the hospital because he's sort of like a friend, okay? And I went up to see him and I spoke to him, and his attitude was brilliant. What he did say was, when I'm injured, I will make no decisions until I'm not injured. I will not let, because obviously your mind is sort of not quite there when you're injured, isn't it? You're thinking outside the square, and you're not really focused on what is one and one making two, the real issues. So he said that I will make no decision until I've calmed down for a couple of days, then I will think it through. Now, I also do believe with Cameron that he won't race unless he honestly believes that he can try to win. I don't think he will race for a satisfactory 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 10th place, which is a fantastic result of this environment anyway, but it's not what Cameron's here to do. He's proven that without any bad luck, he is capable of running with the fastest and even beating them. So I really don't think we're going to see Cameron out there for 5th place. If he comes back on the track at all this week, he will be out there to win, and I know 100% there's no way that his team, TAS Relentless Suzuki, would put him under any pressure whatsoever to ride if he's not 100%. I'm convinced that Hector and Philip Neal will be saying to him, mate, if you are not right, please just sit it out. They would not force him to do anything that he does not want to do.
Well, and that makes perfect sense. Frankly, the TT circuit is not a place where you guess where you guess whether or not you might be healthy. It's not like a short circuit.
No, dead right.
Yeah.
I mean, also the thing here is with a lot of riders, not them all, but a lot of riders, mate, there is a lot of prize money available. You win a superbike race, you've got £22,000.
Whoa.
That's 30 grand, give or take, $30,000. You know,
yeah.
For 2 hours of work, for 2 hours of work of doing something that you absolutely love and live for. You've just been given $30,000. That still, to this day, astounds me that we actually get salaries, bonuses, and prize money to do what we love doing. So I also know, I'm sure, that Cameron will not ride just for money, because you do not ride the Isle of Man TT just for money. That's the wrong reason to be here. It's unsafe.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I'm sure it's down to love and the adoration of the track itself.
Exactly. And also, obviously, the history. There's been some big names here that have done things, you know, some very, very big names. I mean, to me, the most talented rider in the world, full stop, overall, okay, now this is Carl Fogarty. Why? He's won the Isle of Man. He's won on the roads. He's won the World Formula One Championship when it used to exist. He's won World Superbikes many times when it existed. And he got on a privateer bike, and another litre of fuel, he would have finished on the podium on a 500 for the first time in his life. No one else has ever done that. My personal hero is Eddie Lawson from America. He's my personal hero. Mick Doohan is a star. Valentino Rossi is God's son in disguise. but Carl, he's done every single class, everything, and he's been on the podium in every class. He's the man, you know? So there's a lot of people here that you can measure yourself against if you want to.
That's interesting. You mentioned Eddie Lawson. Do you put him up on that pedestal for? I mean, granted, he's a great rider, but what stands out for you?
Apart from his obvious skill, I mean, when he was on the Yamaha, then he went to Honda and he turned that thing into a winning bike again. Apart from any of that, his riding skill, it's his character. It's very similar, actually, to a release just recently on Road Racing World in America, an interview with Matt Mladen. He says, basically, I'm sorry, I did not do my job. I chose the wrong tyre. I am at fault. If he's got any problems with the team, he talks about it inside the truck. He keeps his mouth quiet. He accepts the responsibility for his actions and lack of actions. And that was something Eddie Lawson always did. And he was my hero before I started racing, and he taught me a lot. It's like, do your job or go home. Simple as that, and accept the responsibility that goes with it. Now, if you plan something wrong, fine, that's your result. Don't snivel about it. Don't complain about it. Learn from it. Accept your responsibility. Put your hand up. Say sorry. Move on to the next round and prove everybody wrong at the next round.
Yeah. Solid answer.
Very healthy.
Hey, do me a favor. You know, I can't help but to come back to this, and I'm sure every journalist that you've talked to has asked you about it, but tell me a little bit about your experience with the Britain, because to many, many road racing fans out there, that bike and the man himself, John Britton, were just astounding and something that people still look back on and say, holy cow. Tell me about your ride and your work with the man.
John, bizarre character, an extremely amazing man, and what I consider to be a very, very, very good friend. For example, I might be about to say to you, we're going to go downtown to a restaurant tonight and have steak for tea. John could actually walk up to you and say, we're going to go downtown tonight and stop at the A, walk off, just gone. He might come back an hour later, he might come back 3 days later and see you and go, and have a steak. How bizarre is that? And if he popped back a few minutes later, you could all but guarantee that he'd gone to get a pen and a piece of paper to write down another idea or draw a picture. He was an astounding man. Absolutely astounding. I mean, when it comes to the machine itself, there really wasn't anything too clever on it, was there, in reality and in honesty. Basically, it was an old car front end modified, the way the suspension worked. The trick to it all really was the fact that it was so damn fast, sexy to look at, and really was built in a garden.
Did you find it easy to run the circuit on?
Again, no, I'm sorry to say. The bike did not handle the roads very well at all, and I put it down to two things. One was the swing arm angle. It was way too low, and for the torque of that motor, basically you'd crack the throttle and it would just squat something silly, lift the front wheel stand everywhere and patter off bumps. It did that even on short circuits. If you go back to Andrew Stroud's first race meeting at Daytona with it, and then you go back to his next race meeting at Daytona with it, he was nearly or just over a full second a lap quicker. The only thing they did to the bike was they changed the angle of the swing arm, which the way it was manufactured, that was a major task. It was everything. It wasn't just a matter of changing the eccentrics, because it didn't have eccentrics as such. Okay, so that was the first benefit to it. The real negative side of the handling of the bike, to me, was really the girders, the forks itself. Those girders, obviously carbon fiber, had no flex whatsoever. So what would happen, and even the best Olin's forks or the best showers, they do flex minimal, all right? And the frame has a little bit of flex and give and take in it. Now, that bike was so rigid that what would happen was you'd use up all your suspension stroke, then the tyre would start having to collapse on the sidewalls to deal with a little bit more, then there was nothing left to be done. There was no flex anywhere, so it had to start pattering. That was a letdown on it. If they had bolted an Olin's front end or a whatever front end back into it, it would have been one serious weapon. But John's, I believe, and he told me this himself, so I do believe it, his whole focus after he first designed that motorbike was, wow, I'm actually quite a clever guy here. I want to be in like an avant-garde designer for the world. That was where he was leading himself to. He was basically showing everybody how creative he is. Now come and open your checkbook and ask me to design stuff for you.
You know, there's a term in engineering called not invented here, which means basically if I didn't come up with it, it's not applicable to the problem I'm trying to solve.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, in that same vein, I don't know if you've had a chance yet to look at any of the bikes that are there for the TTX GP electric bike thing that's coming up, but there's some design decisions that I see that had been made or that John had made with the Britain bike that Michael Chiz has picked for his bike, which is kind of a weird project. Have you seen any of those bikes yet?
No, I haven't seen them at all. And to be honest with you, I won't be going to see them because it's not my cup of tea. I like engines, petrol, bang.
I do understand
it might be a part of the future, but no, it's not my cup of tea for now. So I'm busy over here meeting medical people and so forth that help repair me and so forth and sorting out my racing for now on and next year and everything as well. So no, I'm not here for a holiday as such. Sorry to say.
Yeah, I hear you. And so you bring that up, and there was an announcement, I believe, yesterday or Friday that you intend to return next year. Talk to us about that.
100%. What it came down to originally was I did not know exactly what caused the accident, all right?
Yeah.
Now, we now have the proof that it was a mechanical failure, which it wasn't, whatever you say, it was definitely not a Suzuki component, okay?
Okay.
I was on a Suzuki at the time. It was a mechanical failure, but I will not elaborate on that as well because I've done a deal with the company that owned this product where I have seen an email trail of 1,325 emails to all their dealers, suppliers throughout the world to guarantee that this part is not used in the particular way that it was used in which caused my accident. So I can't elaborate on that,
okay,
on what it was. I'm sorry, I've just forgotten what you'd asked me.
Well, tell me about your plans for next year.
That's what it was. Okay, so now that I have signed off on, yes, it was not a rider mistake, I have got a job to do here still to finish it off for Sean Harris only. I'm not coming here to be in a great big flash fancy team or anything silly like that. I've got a Suzuki deal lined up. I've got my crew chief lined up. I've got my accommodation lined up. I've got my leathers, my helmet, my tyres lined up. Simple as that. I'm coming here to finish off what I've been doing since 1991. Because honestly, to me, this place is like home. It really is like home. When I get here, it's like I'm relaxing. It's like I'm on holiday. Even when I'm on the motorbike, tank slapping at 190 mile an hour, to me, this is home. I just love it. So I'm coming back to finish it off.
And what classes do you think you're going to run? Superstock, 1,000, what are you going to run?
One class only, 600s.
Okay, right on.
If someone, I said earlier on, you're not here for money.
Yeah.
That was purely the racing side of it. You shouldn't be racing here to try and get that prize money. But because, without being a big head, because I am a little bit of a name and I'm reasonably competent around here, if someone was to open up their checkbook and put me on a decent superbike, by all means, I will go and give it 100%. But my focus at the moment for Harris himself is purely to come here and finish off the job, which is how I'm going to do it on a 600. Because my crew chief at the time, Kev Stevens, he's what I'd consider my best friend, and any motorbike that he bolts together, I will stretch the heck out of those cables on anywhere, anytime, and he's agreed to come back with me, and he was with me and had to go through the whole incident. I mean, imagine how many times he sat down at night thinking, did I make a mistake, did I make a mistake, did I kill him, you know?
Yeah.
But it was not him in any way, shape, or form to do with it. So the plan is to come back here with Kevin Stevens as my crew chief and on Suzuki 600s. That's my total plan. We have a bike at the moment which is a really good bike. Whether it's that bike that we use or a different Suzuki, that's undecided yet, but I'm definitely doing it on a Suzuki because, again, I've won here on Suzukis. Suzuki New Zealand have looked after me forever and ever and ever, and I feel that I'm a part of the Suzuki family as such. The marketing manager of Suzuki New Zealand I've known for 25 years. I still know him. He's still a friend. So I am a Suzuki rider. I'll ride another motorbike, of course, but my passion really is on the Suzuki, and I love their characteristics.
Yeah, did you look for the Cardenas bike, or have you found something else?
I have not rung that yet because JR said on there purely ring him on Tuesday. He's not back till Tuesday, so it's not Tuesday there yet, is it? I listen to JR sometimes.
Yeah, well, sometimes he's a pretty sharp guy. Now, what are your plans for the next couple of days?
Tonight I'm the flag marshals. This afternoon, there's a great big flag marshals gathering here tonight, and I'm actually running off an auction during the week of, there was 10 particular jerseys team wear made for the Isle of Man when I came and debuted the Britain over here.
Yeah.
Well, I've brought my one with me. We're auctioning that off to give the money to the marshals, and the boots that I was wearing, Style Martin boots that I was wearing when I had the crash, we're auctioning them off as well because I had no foot injuries whatsoever. None whatsoever. So we're also auctioning those boots off over the next few days, and the money I'm giving to the Marshals Association. None of them are going to get a beer or a cup of tea or anything like that out of it, but the Marshals Association itself is going to end up with this money so they can promote their organisation to get more marshals, because I don't care if you've got a £20 million sponsor. Without marshals, you've got no racing because they are free. They do not get paid a cent to do what they do here. It is all complete generosity. Without them, we're nothing.
That's absolutely honorable. I've done some marshalling myself when I wasn't able to race, and I know that riders appreciate it, and I know that in the exact reverse direction, the marshals appreciate the racers. So fantastic for you there.
It is, and I've also just elaborated on it a little bit more. It really is. Last year, a rider called Matt Nelson, who's going extremely well here, he will win a race here. Probably next year. And I'd say he will win a race. He's going to win a race before he finishes, and he won't stop until he finishes, I'm sure. He's very, very similar characteristic to what I was. He's got a focus, he's got a goal, and he's staying focused on it. But I believe that what I'm doing now, he donated a little bit of his prize money last year to the Marshals Association, which was fantastic of him. Now, what I'm doing here now, I believe I've already got three of the big-name riders, and again, I won't use their names until they declare it, but I've already got three of the big-name riders. Next year is going to be mass auctions from the big name riders of their gear that they used in particular races direct. All the money is going to the marshals. So effectively what we're trying to create is similar to JR or whoever's done it, the air fence funding over in the States.
Yeah.
It's a similar thing that I'm trying to help here. And okay, the riders are taken care of. There's a lot of funds over here, like the Joey Dunlop Fund, Lee Pullen Fund, that help injured riders.
Yep.
So injured riders are all but helped out anyway, but no one has been really helping the marshals. This whole thing is about gearing up to help the marshals, which effectively makes our racing safer.
That's fantastic. Good on you. All right. Well, I hope that things go well for you over the next few days, and especially firm everything up for next year. And, Sean, I thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, mate. It's been really appreciated.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Well, that was a whopper of a show, wasn't it? Like I said up front, it was going to be a long one, but a good one. Thanks very much to Sean Harris and Don MD for being on the show. We really appreciate having you guys on. And thanks to Jules and Jim for doing those interviews and getting it all put together and everything, because that was really great stuff. I really enjoyed hearing from those guys. Yeah, so like I mentioned in the call with Jules, I'm doing my Navy two-week training thing, so I'm going to be out of town for the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be away from my email. I'm going to be pretty much cut off starting this weekend here. In fact, I don't even get to watch Catalonia for until 2 weeks after it happens. So, and then Jules is going to be doing the shows during that. That brings us right up to the week right before Laguna Seca. I'll be driving back down to California. We may not have time to do a show that week, or if we do, it's going to be a very, very short one. So the next time that I'm going to be here on a long form, full on show is going to be after Laguna Seca, July 7th. So it's going to be a while. Have a good time. Thanks very much, Jules. And if you are going to Laguna Seca, I hope you get a chance to say hello. I'll be the guy wandering around wearing a MotoGPOD t-shirt. And it's going to be a really, really great time. If you haven't got your tickets yet, make sure you check out either the Powersport Dynamic Turn 5 Chalet or Pole Position Travel has some excellent packages. There's links on the MotoGPOD website for both of those places. We'll put it in the show notes again. If you haven't quite finalized your decisions, they've all got some excellent packages of great way to go to see the races there at Laguna Seca. Got me tickets in the mail, and so I'm starting to get a little excited. That's going to be something to look forward to right after my Navy 2 weeks and all that business. So it's a busy month coming up here. And that's going to do it for tonight. Thanks again for downloading the show, and we will talk to you again later. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.